badge card.
I guess there's only senior officers stayed longer.
Right, only the senior officers stayed longer. Even I was on 12 hours, I mean 12 months orders, but I escaped in 13 with you.
That also brings to mind another larger issue, and that is, I guess, the view that Lyndon Johnson, for political reasons, for his domestic program, wanted war never to be that big a factor in American society. And so you don't want to, for example, you don't want to go to the reserves. You don't want to do things that will affect the economy too much. You don't want to raise taxes. How much do you think that perception that Johnson creates through managing policy in that manner, how did that filter down to you at the level that you were at and to the troops that you commanded?
We called it guns and butter. And you're right that he did not want to see military budgets increased, and therefore what inevitably happened was not, as you perhaps inferred, a deterrence in the support for the forces out there, but forces elsewhere suffered, as a result of which the Navy, for example, had a Navy that was on the average obsolescent. Our ships were on the average 19 years of age when I took over as CNO, because we'd spent our money for bombs and bullets and attrition aircraft and had not replaced ships at an adequate rate. And the same thing was true of the other services. Our overall preparedness to fight the Russians was deteriorating because we were using up our substance fighting that war in Vietnam. And the net result of that was that the evaluations that I, as the Joint Chief, and others in the Joint Chiefs reported to the President during the 4 years that I was CNO was that if we'd had to fight the Russians, the odds are we would lose. I had to report that we were down to about a 35% probability of victory in a war with the Soviet Union. And in my second year there, I heard General Westmoreland report that, well, each year, the Army Chief of Staff said that we didn't have the conventional strength in Europe to prevent Western Europe from being overrun, and that only the nuclear deterrent was holding the Russians back. And in my second year there, the Chief of Staff of the Air Force informed President Nixon that we had less than a 50% probability of victory in an air war. That was the awesome impact of fighting the Vietnam War on a guns and butter basis. Mm-hmm. And it was for that reason that I decided that we had to just go ahead and bite the bullet and take the risk of even less immediate readiness to eliminate enough ships to start the building of ships that in the long run would bring us back to that 600 ship Navy that would give us a greater than 50% probability of victory.
Mm-hmm. Went back to South Vietnam two further times after becoming CNO. Each time you returned, did you feel that things had changed since you departed, and was that for the better or for the worse? Did you see a deterioration? Did you, each time you visited, what was your sense of how things were going to happen in South Vietnam?
My sense was, and of course I paid primary attention to the Navy, mm-hmm. on those revisits. My sense was that the program was going extremely well, and in my private conversations that I had with Admiral Chan, he had the same feeling. I felt that the relationship had suffered during Admiral King's tenure, but had been rebuilt by Admiral Salzer. And Admiral Salzer was confident that things were going to work. Yes, they had problems. Yes, things didn't work quite as well as they did when we were all U.S. But he was basically bullish that Chan was making the thing working. Now, with regard to the Army part of it, General Abrams, each time that I was there, felt that basically things were on track. Mm-hmm. Each time that as a member of the Joint Chiefs, we had to comment on the president's decision to withdraw another increment. We were always faced with the fact that Secretary of Defense and the president had decided that on X day they were going to remove Y troops. What do you guys think about it? Our answer each time was that's really stretching. It's going to be very tight, but we'll have to support it, is in essence the decision that we made. And even when the major attack across the DMZ was made and our forces were driven back, we felt good that General Trum was able to drive back up and recapture Hue, and the forces didn't fall apart, and showed that with our support from the air, they could handle it.
Was this the Easter Offensive or the 75 campaign?
No, 72. Easter Offensive of 72.
Yeah, it was the Easter Offensive. Yeah.
So when that took place, this major attack, and South Vietnam was able to repulse it, and of course there's a great deal of American air power involved in this. What is your view from Washington of how Vietnam responds to this, and then, if anything, that from the naval point of view?
We felt good. We felt that that they held together and followed their doctrine. It reinforced our conviction that they were going to have continuing U.S. air support, and the truce therefore called for it. That secret agreement. But with that caveat that we were going to have to continue to give them air support, I think all the chiefs thought the system could work. Mm-hmm. And even as late as the truce in 1973, which took place after Mr. Nixon's re-election, we didn't visualize that the constitutional crisis was going to lead to the disemboweling of the president and the total loss of support within Congress for continuing that. Support to the Vietnamese.
In terms of Nixon, and I ask this as it pertains to Vietnam, you support his re-election in 1972?
Yes, I did, because his opponent was McGovern, who is a very nice gentleman, a very idealistic gentleman, but who just had a gross misapprehension, a gross misunderstanding of the need for military capability. And his proposal was just to pull us out and let the war go, which would have been a disaster, as ultimately occurred anyway. Mm-hmm. But it would have been the kind of a disaster that it would be unexplainable, whereas the Watergate crisis is an explainable thing. So when I was in California, I was asked by the press what would happen if McGovern was advocating a $25 billion reduction in our defense budget. I was asked the question, what would happen in the event of his program being implemented, and I said, well, that's a political question and I can't get into politics, so let me just give you the implications of a theoretical reduction of $30 billion. So we'd have to close up all but one base on the West Coast and all but one base on the East Coast, and we'd have to make major reductions in our number of our ships. And that was written up, and the White House was delighted with the report, and I think it did help carry California. For Nixon, I thought it was just a sensitive act. You know,
bless you.
In the light of what we now know, it's a closer question as to whether or not we would have been that much worse off with McGovern. But I think, on balance, that we would have been worse off because it would have been a less supportable occurrence than the way in which the debacle finally played itself out.
The question of McGovern raises the issue in my mind of what was your opinion of events in the United States during your time in Vietnam? That is, the chaos, the upheaval. What were your feelings about the anti-war movement at the time?
I felt very strongly that they were harmful to the U.S. national interest. I felt that Jane Fonda, to this day I feel that she was a traitor to the United States of America, as was Carl Weiss. They were actively working with the communist regime in Hanoi. And Jane Fonda lied to the American public in her public announcements over there about the prisoners of war being well treated while they were being tortured. And to this day, if I should ever encounter her, I would refuse to shake her hand. I think she's a dreadful, dreadful person. And I think that group of leadership of the dissent movement led to the death of many thousands of additional Americans.
Did you notice that that much in Vietnam, or were you too busy to pay attention to the social conditions in the United States?
We were reading the headlines in the papers and thought about it, worried about it. But in the course of a day's time, probably spent 10 or 15 minutes on that, and the rest of our day taking care of our business.
Certainly. Now, you mentioned Jane Fonda as a specific example, but if you look at American society after Tet, 1969, 1970, when the word of the Cambodian incursion comes out and there's an enormous backlash against that, just this general sense among younger Americans, college-age Americans, that support for the war is steadily draining away.
Yes, that sort of thing was why we knew that no matter who was elected, we were going to face this problem of having to get out. And the question was how to do it on the least worst basis, you know. It was clear that support was attenuating all the time. I personally believe that minus Watergate, Mr. Nixon would still have been able to maintain better than a 50% support within the country, because even at its worst, prior to the Watergate thing getting quite hot, Nixon was able to get congressional support for the budgets, congressional support for a gradual withdrawal rather than a fast withdrawal. So I think that the basic core of American support was there despite the dissent, minus Watergate. That's debated by other people, obviously, who disagree with that. But my own conviction is that a Nixon without Watergate could have brought it off.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of the effect of the anti-war movement is perception.
Yeah.
And I suppose my question is then, what do you perceive it as having that much of an effect at the time?
I perceived it as making it mandatory for Mr. Nixon to have a gradual withdrawal. I perceived it as forcing us to withdraw faster than I would have liked, but nevertheless I perceived it as something that was going to work out well in terms of our national interest over time.
Do you think it had any effect on the knowledge among the entire American military personnel establishment in Vietnam? And in terms of the Navy specifically, from your view, did the perception of events in the United States, did that harm morale in any way, or did that harden your determination to do a good job?
There was some impact on morale. Guys would come back from R&R saying that I got spat upon or I got jeered, that sort of thing. But there was a tremendous feeling that, certainly among the Navy guys, that what they were doing was right, and as they saw the conversion from U.S. to Vietnamese coming along, ships getting more and more Vietnamese crew in them, the homes being built and the fortresses growing and so forth, I think that morale on balance remained high. Emmett, are you going to comment on that?
I would agree with that. There was an anger created by it. I don't believe that the students at home had an impact on us other than anger. I'm talking about the men out on the rivers. They felt like that they were wrong. The Fonda thing, though, was a real hurt all of us. We felt there was a traitor in the midst. What was the name of Carl who?
Cora Weiss.
Weiss.
Weiss. She was the admitted communist who was...
Right. Well, she at least admitted it, yeah. And Jane Fonda didn't. And
basically, I think the military forces, even not in Vietnam, supported Mr. Nixon's view. There's that wonderful vignette of when the Pentagon was being marched on, and they had soldiers there to guard and keep them from overflowing into the Pentagon. One bearded, loathsome-looking guy yelled up to a soldier, "Come on down here, buddy, and join us." And the soldier yelled back, "Sorry, buddy, I haven't had the necessary shots." And that just sort of put it in context.
Mm-hmm. How did you respond to the political backlash following the withdrawal from Vietnam in terms of a piece of legislation like the War Powers Act?
Well, that was clearly a result of Watergate. As of the time of the truce, I think there was a tremendous amount of support for Mr. Nixon in Congress and in the public, and I do not believe the War Powers Act would have been enacted even if Mr. Nixon had to use air power two or three more times to make sure the truce violations were properly met. Mm-hmm. The War Powers Act was enacted under President Ford after Nixon had left office. And it was with the total disgrace of Richard Nixon, at that point then, with all support in the country having gone down the drain for the residue of the Nixon administration presided over by Mr. Ford, Congress was able to put the War Powers Act through. And as I recall, Ford signed it. It wasn't override on a veto. I think he just signed it on the basis that he didn't see any way that it wouldn't be overridden. I hope I'm right on that. You better check it. In any event, Mr. Ford felt powerless to do anything more than what he did when he sent the ships to rescue the merchant ships that had been captured in Cambodian waters.
Well,
Mayaguez, yeah. That he felt that he was not able to do when the conventional invasion of 1975 came along, what Nixon had promised President II he would do. Mm-hmm. So the War Powers Act was the final coup de grace for Vietnam.
You see the War Powers Act then as more of a backlash against Nixon than against the perception that with something like the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, the president had too much power to act independent of Congress, and Congress was trying to rein the executive in.
That was clearly part of what was articulated as the reasoning for it, but the political support for doing so came as a result of the Nixon disgrace, I think.
So they kind of fed on one another.
Yeah.
Those two.
Right.
Once you're finished, I suppose this comes even after you're finished at CNO. What was your feeling when you saw, when you observed the events in South Vietnam and Saigon in April of 1975?
One of just absolute horror at what had befallen our Vietnamese allies and what had befallen us. I knew that we were in for deep trouble with our foreign policy for the next several years because America had been disgraced around the world, and America was seen for the next several years to be a paper tiger. As a result of which, the Russians began the flying of $400 million worth of equipment into Angola and flew 20,000 Cuban troops into Angola and just took Angola right away from us, put it behind the Iron Curtain. Over time, we were able to regain a presence there through Savimbi and the CIA, but the oil of Angola was denied us as a result of that disgrace. The Russians moved rapidly to do the same thing in Mozambique and then in Ethiopia, so we began to lose one country after another. The People's Democratic Republic of Yemen, And one could foresee that happening because we were perceived as being a paper tiger, and the American people had lost their taste for supporting national interests overseas for a while. That, in turn, had its backlash. It was at its very worst during the Carter era, and the backlash led to the election of Ronald Reagan, who recreated a bullish foreign policy and ended up with the final defeat of the evil empire. So, you know, again, in the light of history, you have to ask yourself, was it good or bad that we went through that period? Because we needed the backlash from that to elect the kind of a guy, Ronald Reagan, who probably could never have been elected had Mr. Nixon not suffered Watergate. So, you know, you play these permutations and combinations, but it was a very tough period for those of us that were interested in seeing a stable world community as a result of the loss of
these nations that you mentioned that tumbled never are mentioned by those who say the domino theory was just a myth. That it,
yeah, I started to say that yesterday and then decided it just was overtaken by events. But you could just tick off. People say the domino theory didn't make sense, but let's just look. East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Hungary, Bulgaria, Romania, then the ones in Africa that I've just mentioned, and then Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam, Cuba, Grenada, one after another, they were going over.
You felt sort of actually almost numb watching the helicopters fly off the roof of the embassy.
Yeah, not to mention the fact that we left behind millions of South Vietnamese who had believed in this. And, you know, a million of them got out, but the vast majority of them stayed there and suffered those horrible years under communism when many of the most supportive of us suffered. Admiral Chan, 12 years in a prison camp, repatriation camp. Many others tortured and killed.
Did you have any sense at the time, and this is just out of curiosity that I asked this, you commented on how the United States went into a period of being perceived as a paper tiger where it could not seem to get its act together in terms of a coherent, unified foreign policy. Did you have any feeling at the time, 1975, when Vietnam had passed away, that it would take so long for the country to come to grips with the experience simply because after 1975, people seemed to want to just forget about Vietnam for a long time, and then now we're trying to come to grips with what the whole thing was, what it meant to the United States, what it means to our experience.
Yeah, I was very pessimistic for the near term because each subtraction of a country from the free world and the acquisition of it by the Iron Curtain or the Bamboo Curtain was a net loss in strength. And at that time, the Soviet Union seemed to be growing at an impressive rate in power, not only by these territorial acquisitions, but by virtue of the resources that it brought to them. And they clearly, we knew, as a result of our calculations in the Nixon era, made worse in the Carter era by defense reductions, that we were inferior to the Soviet military capability. But with the reaction of the American public when Afghanistan was invaded, I could begin to see the turnaround. And I then began to believe that there was an excellent prospect that we could defeat Mr. Carter and get a Republican administration that would begin to build up and take a more aggressive foreign policy stance.
Mm-hmm. Left Vietnam to become CNO and assumed that position. How much during that time in Washington was Vietnam a factor in your daily experience, or were you much more concerned with personnel issues, with preparing the fleet to face the Soviet Union? Did Vietnam very much sort of fade off in your thinking, or did it Was it always there?
It was always there, but whereas in Vietnam, 68 to 70, it had been 95% of my thought process during the day, it became more like 25% of the thought process, because basically I felt pretty comfortable that things were going well there, and I had this desperate feeling that we had to get on with modernizing the fleet to meet the Soviet threat. We had to make the American public aware of the nature of the Soviet threat. We knew that we were going to lose draft pressure, which had always kept the Navy full of volunteers to avoid the draft. By 1973, we knew therefore that these changes in personnel systems had to go into effect, because that reenlistment reg would not support a Navy once you lost draft pressure to bring in replacements. So those were the things that took 75% of the time. The public relations, to keep the public aware of the danger, the battle to make the Navy representative of the nation and race and gender, and to eliminate the Mickey Mouse, and the battle to get the Project 60 programs built for 18-hour days.
I think you might want to tell us about your difficulties and lack of freedom in informing the American public.
Yeah, the fact that we would lose the war if we had to fight it was reported first to the president and then to the congressional committees in classified testimony. We were not permitted to say to the public that that would happen. What I was able to do through meetings with, we would bring influence makers in, publishers and chief executive officers and people like David Rockefeller and so forth, in groups of 10 or 12, and brief them off the record. I talked to Senator Jackson to ask him who in the Democratic Party I could begin to pry away, and he recommended Ben Wattenberg and Richard Shifter, both of whom at that time were part of the liberal anti-defense establishment. We got both of those converted, and they've been lifelong supporters of strong defense ever since. But that had to be done with the understanding that they weren't going to go out and go public about the fact that we would lose the war. People like that were very helpful when it came time to get key votes through the Congress. It was always surprising to find that a senator who had absolutely refused to consider my appeal would change his vote after he heard from a key player in his state and suddenly decide that he liked the Navy program. So we got at it in that way, but we weren't able to go to the public and say, if we fight the Soviet Union, the odds are we'll lose the naval war.
That remained classified at the time?
Right. Now, I did publish it in my book in 1976.
Did that cause any stir, that releasing some of the information in your book?
I didn't clear the book with the Pentagon, and nobody ever raised it.
Never became an issue.
That's right. I don't know why. They had every right to court-martial me for it. But
I'm surprised Kissinger didn't try and raise a fuss about it.
Well, especially given some of the comments you make about the Nixon White House and the way it was run.
Right.
Very interesting. I'm telling everyone too that I was never aware, or at least not to the extent that I am now, of the way Kissinger operated until I read the perception of Kissinger from the military standpoint, which of course your standpoint. Do you think the other chiefs had the same view of him from your discussions with them?
They did, but they were less willing to do anything about it in that final terrible month that I write about, my last month in office. They were unwilling. When I learned by going to C Chief Schlesinger, why the JCSMs, the chief's positions on this SALT treaty that Nixon was planning to sign in Moscow in June of 1974. Why our positions opposing it weren't getting to the president. Schlesinger said, here they are. Kissinger has ordered me not to send any more over in the name of the president. No more advice from the chiefs. I went to the chiefs and said, we have a statutory obligation to advise the president. We should send a letter directly to the president, copy to the Secretary of Defense, showing that a copy went to the Secretary of Defense, so that it's clear on the record that we bypassed him, but that he knows about it. And any seaman second class can do that. And the chiefs wouldn't join me in it, so I sent the letter myself. It caused that big furor. I think that the chiefs just showed a lack of guts at that time. History with regard to Agent Orange is as follows. The first time I became distinctly aware that there was possible human danger involved was when on April 15th of 1970, the Defense Department outlawed its use. This was just as I came back to be interviewed for that CNO's job. Four departments outlawed it simultaneously: Interior, Agriculture, Defense, and one other department, Interior, I believe. Did I say that first? Anyway, there were four departments that outlawed 245T, which was one of the two major elements in Agent Orange. The reason they outlawed it was that it was discovered that it caused birth defects in animals. And there had been a village in Oregon, Alsea, A-L-S-E-A, where a nearby national park or reserve had been sprayed with 245T, and some mothers delivered children with birth defects in greater than normal numbers. So the Defense Department said, well, that's one of the components of Agent Orange, we'll outlaw it too. Nevertheless, doctors treating Elmo when he came down with cancer in 1983, and we asked them, said, well, it hasn't really been established scientifically. So in the various programs that Elmo and I were on, where he was and I were being interviewed about the fact the media were fascinated with the fact that I had used Agent Orange and my son now had it, we said that the medical science doesn't yet support the conclusion that there is a correlation, but we believe there probably is. And I left it at that. After Elmo passed away in August of 1988, the following year, former Congressman Ed Derwinski, who I'd worked pretty closely with on the home porting issues, he chaired the foreign, a senior public member of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the House. He was now President Bush's administrator of the VA, and he called me in and asked me if I would be his unpaid special assistant and review everything to recommend to him what he should do about his responsibility of deciding whether or not there was a correlation between Agent Orange and disease in Vietnam veterans. So I spent 7 months working on it. I reviewed hundreds of studies myself and then went over them with a group of scientists in whom I had confidence. And I gathered a lot of documents from the Defense Department and from the Bureau of the Budget, bumped into, and I went through the transcripts about this high of the work, the verbatim record of deliberations of the Committee on Environmental Health Hazards, which had been set up to advise the Secretary of Veterans Affairs as to whether or not there was a correlation. Congress had set this up by statute. With regard to the work in those transcripts, I was able to as I went through it, find places where the committee would be about ready to decide that a given study had showed a positive relationship between Agent Orange dioxin and the disease. And then as the discussion went on, there were two or three docs that would sort of talk the consensus away from positive to being neutral. Or if a study, the consensus began to sound like it was negative and was neutral, you could see these same two or three docs talking it over to where the consensus ended up calling it negative, no correlation. And so I marked these and then went over those places in the transcript with two scientists that I had confidence in, and they said it was clear that these guys were maneuvering the consensus. So then we checked on them, and it turned out that they were people who had worked for corporations or had consulted for them or had given testimony in their behalf. And then as a separate matter, I found out from some of the documents from the Bureau of the Budget given to me by friendly sources, I found two directives in which a fellow by the name of Horowitz, an attorney at a policy level in the Bureau of the Budget, had issued orders that said, in essence, it would be most unfortunate if any government agency found a correlation between Agent Orange and disease. And it went on to list two reasons. A, because it would be costly for the government to support compensation for the veterans. And B, it would cause tort liabilities for certain corporations. The damn guy had gone so far as to put in writing the reasons for not wanting to do so, which were, I thought, devastating. So I persuaded Congressman, the late Congressman Ted Weiss, who was chairman of a subcommittee on government operations, to hold a series of hearings. We brought these people in. I testified in front of them. And he was able to document and issue a devastating report on how the Bureau of the Budget had manipulated the government agencies. As a result of which, corporations' studies that had been manipulated and government studies that had been manipulated led to no significant outcomes with regard to Agent Orange. So in my report to Mr. Dewinsky in May of 1990, I recommended that I stated that in my judgment there were probably 28 diseases that ought to be made compensable if true and honest scientific studies were done. I recommended that the Committee on Environmental Health Hazards be disestablished because it was fraudulent. And I recommended that diseases immediately be recognized where it was clear and unassailable already in the science. To his great credit, Derwinski went to President Bush, and Bush overruled the Bureau of the Budget and approved the first three diseases, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, soft tissue sarcoma, and chloracne. About the same time that I reported out, a scientific committee that had been established by the American Legion reported out conclusively that 13 diseases were now of such scientific correlation that they should be made compensable. The Congress disestablished the Committee on Environmental Health. Well, I should point out first that Derwinski, for my pains, made me a member of the Committee on Environmental Health Hazards. And if you've ever seen a guy treated like a pariah, when I went into this committee, they first decided they wanted to write a letter recommending that I be removed from the committee. And then they decided that probably wouldn't stand. So it was really almost fun the way in which they...
Was this in an open meeting with you?
Yeah, and we had a series of about three or four meetings, and then finally Congress disestablished them. So essential justice was done. Afterward, I got a letter from Dr. Len Curlin, who is a prestigious doctor on that committee, working for Mayo Clinic, saying he simply couldn't understand why I continued to try to mislead veterans and give them false hope that there were going to be compensation for these diseases. And I went back and told him that I was doing it because I was honestly convinced, and that I believed that if I lived, I'd get 28 diseases, and I take great pleasure in sending him a copy of each new decision that comes through. The next stage was Congress, in disestablishing the committee, gave the responsibility to the National Academy of Sciences, who made a contract with the Institute of Medicine to report out every 2 years on the state of the science. Their first report in 1993 gave us six more diseases, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs recognized, and then their second report, which didn't get out until actually 96, early 96, gave us four more diseases, including the first birth defects, and you'll be interested, Emmett, gave us prostate cancer, so that people like Jerry Wages have a chance to get a better break for their widow if they succumb. And the one birth defects that we finally have gotten approved is spinal bifida, which it's clear that there is elevation in the children of Vietnam veterans. But we will get more birth defects in time, particularly developmental birth defects. So the process is on a formalized basis now, and it's getting increasingly more difficult for the guys to fight it. In 1995, the EPA came out with a draft reassessment of dioxin, and I've been active in trying to get that approved, and the chemical companies, paper mill companies, are fighting that hard, trying to get it not converted to a final version, because it clearly finds that there are developmental defects and neurological defects resulting from exposure to dioxin, which of course is a major component, a component of Agent Orange. And when the Republicans came to power, they, under Congressman Robacher from California, set up a system for trying to debunk a number of environmental things. And with regard to this draft reassessment, they called hearings in which they called in the EPA people who had done the study, and then had as a second panel a bunch of so-called scientists who were company docs, in essence. And we got a whole bunch of letters written and demanded a third panel that would try to put in context what this second panel had said. The best we could do is get me, but Robacher wouldn't approve any scientist beyond that third panel. Fortunately, I was able to find in the transcripts of the hearings of the Scientific Advisory Committee reviewing the draft dioxin report, which had company docs in it, an unbelievable statement made by a doctor who said, those of us who have some of the bread on our table put there by the work we do for corporations should be forgiven if from time to time our scientific judgments appear to be askew or worse to that effect. And I was able to quote that in my response to the two panels, which was very helpful, and the final report didn't go anywhere. Well, I talked too long on that issue, but...
No, it's an essential one. It's not going to be ongoing.
You think Les is beginning to look glassy-eyed?
Well,
I think
no, that's, no, that just gives you a little preliminary thinking to do, because there's nowhere where I've set that all down about the various activities.
Well, that's a tremendous sequence. So now there's a total of how many diseases?
We're up to a total of 13 diseases
that have been approved of
right,
the 28.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes the latest four.
Right.
Well, one thing I read to ask you, Admiral, before we stop, was there anything in your mind that I did not ask you about your Vietnam experience that you would like to include or have relevance?
I can't think of anything. Can you, Emmett?
We'll look it over, and I think after the transcripts boil down, I'm sure there are going to be some instances that we'll think of, some of which can be anecdotes to add some color to it.
Yes, sir, I would like to have some of those, too. That's going to be important.
And, you know, if you get those verbal histories that were done by the three fellows that I mentioned to you, that'll give you some anecdotal stuff too, and may lead to some more questions.
Right.
Okay.
One of which would be, well, the contact, my last correspondence with Howard Kerr, I guess, was in February, and his letter was very upbeat, said there was hope. Have you heard recently?
Yes, I talked to Howard, I guess, a week or 10 days ago. His doctor tells him that he absolutely believes he's cured. A, because they got it early, and B, because his particular variant of leukemia has a very high rate of total recovery.
Right.
It's apparently an unusual strain that is easier to knock out. He recovered his strength from the third and final of his chemotherapies and felt good. He had just finished selling the second half of his chicken-producing company.
Oh, yeah.
And netted a very handsome bonus.
I'm sure he
did. So, and he and Priscilla are planning in July to go off to Scotland and then settle in Oxford for 3 months, where they're going to take a course on the Crusades, something they both have been interested in.
Okay.
And then he's going to come back and start looking for something to do. But, it looks as though it's worked out.
That's wonderful. Here's another one of the many staff that had a form of cancer, leukemia, in later life.
And all of them were out in exposed areas. Emmett was, Howard was.
The Admiral was.
Yeah. All right, we're knock on wood again.
I want to thank
knock on the actual wood.
Emmett and Brett, letting me sit here, because it's really just tickled me to death to find out who actually... because I remember